And we're back. It is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT at 9.5 FM. I want to tell you about Mr. Hoyle and his book, just in case we're doing our best and we've got the right number. But sometimes I've had guests who sit by the phone and think, well, that's not the one. I'm waiting for my call, but they don't pick up the one that is the call. Anyway, he has written a book called Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And this was published in 2014. The beauty of this book, and the reason I'm calling it to your attention, I'm not asking you to go buy it. You can go to the Africa Research Center at Africa Research Center. You will find a list of books and articles. Very well done. This is high caliber stuff. Mr. Hoyle is a PhD and very well qualified to do this. It's a 625 book page book. But you can download it. This is a free book. And it's kind of like that old title, Everything You Wanted to Know But Afraid to Ask. It's in the book. We're interested in talking about this subject because, as I say, later in the show, we're going to be talking to a member of the Women's Action for Peace in Burundi. And they're very concerned that their president is being targeted by the international court system, they can't understand why this targeting is going on. How is it possible that you have this international tribunal, the ICC? It's located in The Hague, and so far, more than $1 billion have been spent since it was set up. More than a decade ago. And there are, so far, 32 indictments. Every single one of the 32 is an African. Every single one. And it's called the International Criminal Court. And boy, it is criminal. It is, and it is time to definitely take a stand. Everyone should understand. There, unfortunately, Phil, you know about this, there's a tendency when people are angry, you know, one country against the other, I'm going to take you to the ICC. I've heard about it in the case of the Palestinians. They say, well, we're going to take the Israelis because of Gaza, take you to the ICC. No, that's not how it works. And unfortunately, people buy into the rhetoric and they use the rhetoric. They shouldn't do it because this is a bankrupt court. It's not bankrupt in that they all got plenty of money, but it is morally, ethically, legally bankrupt. And they have had people, in custody for 6 years. They were holding them. These are Africans, holding them. And then it turns out they have nothing. Their case collapses. It's a disgrace. And yet, people wearing, the garments of power and UN officials, whatnot, who are very well paid, by the way. There's not a one of them that doesn't make above 200 grand. All the ones you're looking at, when you know, those guys are all above 200 grand a year. That's U.S., and it can't be taxed, incidentally. So for those of you who are aspiring crooks, you know, get in on the ground floor. This is where the money is. They don't pay taxes on that. I could go on and on about what that business. But you take the case of the son of Jomo Kenyatta, Uhuru, Freedom. His name is Freedom. Kenyatta, he gets elected to be president of Kenya, and all of a sudden the International Criminal Court said, oh, well, we have some charges here. And, you know, Kenya was respectful of the court. They played ball. I mean, they said, well, what are the charges? What do you want? This and that. And they put up the appropriate barriers of, you know, we are a sovereign country. We do have our own laws, and we have the people who enforce them. So, but they went along. And Mr. Hoyle, in his book, points out that one of the things a prosecutor immediately wanted to do or got permission to do was freeze the money belonging to President Kenyatta and of other accused. Freeze it. And as Dr. Hoyle points out, there is a word, there's a kind of a concept most of us are familiar with, which is presumption of innocence. But they were going to take his money while they held him to go on with the trial. And just phenomenal. Well, speaking of things that are phenomenal, we have phenomenally reached Dr. David Hoyle, and he is the author of Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And you can get this at Africa Research Center. Are you there, Dr.
Hoyle? I am, yes, indeed.
Well, it's great to talk to you. I was just explaining to our listeners that we, later in the show, we're going to be talking to someone from the Women in Action for Peace in Burundi. And they are very concerned that their president is being talked about in upper echelon UN circles, but particularly people with nice titles about human rights, this or opposition to genocide committee. And they don't understand why this targeting is going on and how that mechanism works, as though there's a presumption of guilt and there's a presumption that if a report were to come down from one of these, from this commission, they could suffer further sanctions. They could suffer all kinds of problems. Could you talk about that? From your book, I'd say I don't know anybody better versed on the topic.
Well, I think your background is a very distinct one also in that respect. I think at the end of the day, it boils down to lawfare, an attempt to use things that are actually presented as instruments of law or a attempt to use mechanisms, legal mechanisms, or mm-hmm. pseudo-legal mechanisms as an instrument of politics. And this is, of course, nothing new, but it's actually something we've seen as increasingly used, especially on the African continent, I think, in the last 20-odd years. And this is, one more example of that.
Mm-hmm. This is Dr. David Hoyle. And your book, you point out some very interesting phenomenon. I guess this, and this has to do with the practically all the operations that base themselves on this, what they say, the Security Council, that money is involved here in terms of people are interested, like the Burundians that I speak to, Rwandans, others. How does the selection process work? That, for example, I'm going to take the case of the Sierra Leone and its neighbor. When they prosecuted there, it turned out that the team of prosecutors was actually all American lawyers, but not just lawyers. They came from the United States Army and Air Force, most of them. How could that happen?
Well, I think it's obviously no mistake. It's a mechanism that has been used, I think, actually not only in terms of what happened in Syria and Liberia, but also, of course, in terms of the other cases actually for the Rwanda trial. You had an incredibly large percentage of not just actually serving or reserve American officers, but in fact also serve American intelligence officers mm-hmm. who were actually cropping up all through the structure of the court, and of course in some cases also as judges. So, the simple fact is the United States, United Nations Security Council is the world's most political body, and of course is actually dominated by the Permanent Five, and obviously in over recent years and decades, specifically by the United States. And these tribunals were actually in large part established or considered controlled by Washington, and as a result, have been seen and can be seen as an instrument of American foreign policy. And just to reinforce that, you do have all the way through the personnel, individuals who actually, were members of the American military establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there as judges, as administrators, as investigators, as researchers, and bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out a very important fact, and it certainly played a role in the ad hoc tribunals of Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and Sierra Leone, and elsewhere. And people forget there was a whole crop of these weeds that grew up and now are disappearing without anybody saying where whatever happened. That money could be put into the effort without the question being raised of whether or not it was parties that were would have a conflict. States can put in money to pay for these tribunals, but also individuals and other entities, and as far as I know, they're not identified.
That's exactly right. And this actually exists, I think, even to this day in terms of the...
I could buy a court if I was Soros. I could...
Well, I mean, and I think...
I suspect him, by the way.
Of speculation that may have also been the case. Even today, even in terms of the International Criminal Court and their funding, there was a bit of controversy very early on because that exact mechanism was also mooted and, in terms of the funding for the ICC. So, yes, it's been one of those very stark gray areas. And as we know, I mean, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And we've actually seen this increasingly, more and more self-evident now in terms of the activities of the ICC, where you have a court which receives up to anywhere between 60% and 70% of its funding for one bloc, ultimately, which is the European Union bloc. Mm-hmm. If you add up all the EU states, their contributions actually to the ICC, it comes in at that figure or between those figures.
Yes.
And it literally does control the court. Where you have funds also coming into courts from NGOs and, as you mentioned, from individuals and other states, that also is a very, very questionable and, yeah, and very, malleable source of income.
I have to tell you, David, I laughed out loud. I was reading your book today, some of it, and at one point when they acknowledged, United Nations acknowledged that there were this independent individuals could give them money, they said that they had to give a statement that they weren't trying to influence anybody.
Well, I'm sure that works.
If you do that, in broad daylight, actually, you wouldn't even be a very good con man. People say, well, actually, your trickery isn't that great. I mean, that's not going to work.
As you will know yourself all too well, the key to any court is its independence. If your court is in any way seen not to be independent or to be tied to funding or to politics or to party or to a state, that then eats like acid into the credibility of that institution. And this is exactly where we are with a number of these international tribunals and also with the ICC as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in terms of the ICC, there's a very similar mechanism into the independent criminal court our tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, which of course are those mechanisms that are specifically controlled by the UN Security Council. In terms of the ICC, they actually give the UN Security Council special prosecutorial rights of referral and deferral. So, the ICC, just like these other courts, just like these other international criminal tribunals, is not independent. It actually affords special rights to the world's most political entity, the UN Security Council.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book documents that the money comes from primarily the European Union, and of course, no European is charged with anything. Only Africans are charged. And I want to link this to this again, once again, to this matter. One of the most visible members of the UN is Samantha Powers, who wrote the book and all this, and a big advocate of these tribunals. Now, she's gone out of her way to visit Burundi and try to browbeat the president. And now we're getting this, you know, special report being written, which sounds like, you know, basically a policeman putting you on notice that he intends to use some kind of coercion against you. Now, the question is, how does U.S. get its way? China has shown itself as a member of Security Council very sensitive on the issue of national sovereignty and tends to abstain and that sort of thing. Nonetheless, though, the personnel are pretty much American appointees or people that they're very comfortable with. Do you see any changing? Because we do seem to be in a new mode here with Mr. Putin now being one who they say is not willing to go along and therefore he's an evil person. Are they this exercise of running things through the Security Council and then bullying and trying to cause regime change, is that, do you detect any change in the climate?
I think I do, and I date it back to the Libyan intervention in 2011. I mean, exactly as you've said, I think, you know, certainly before 2011, the Russians and Chinese were, you know, sort of willing to take a back seat on most issues linked into certain aspects of the work of the UN Security Council. But as you know, to justify the Western military intervention in Libya, the Americans and the Europeans went through a process of getting certain resolutions passed through the UN Security Council. And, of course, a part of that was, you know, the concept of a no-fly zone. And it is linked into, of course, indictments or a referral of events in Libya to the ICC. And the ICC responded in super fast time. I mean, normally, to move actually from an investigation or a referral stage to investigation to indictments can take up to, you know, 3 or 4 years. In the case of Libya, the ICC very conveniently moved within a matter of weeks.
Yes.
In some cases, actually, days, really.
They found Viagra in a matter of 24 hours, I think.
That's right. I mean, it was actually quite extraordinary. And what they did in effect was they actually provided the indictments and NATO provided the war. And the no-fly zone, as you know, grew to a no-drive, no movement, no military zone at all. So NATO basically agreed that arbitrarily to justify actually literally destroying every single Libyan military institution or formation they could actually identify. And then, of course, that ultimately won the war actually for the NATO forces and the Islamist militias, of course, who they were actually acting as the air force for. Now,
yes, a Canadian military officer said, "We are Al Qaeda's air force."
That's exactly what it was, and I mean, that's one of the law of unintended consequences, which is, you know, NATO amazingly actually provided exactly that service for militias that would subsequently morph into ISIS, militias that were actually, in effect, Al-Qaeda militias, even then, back in 2011. But come the issue, of course, that in Syria, where the UN Security Council was also invoked, or there were attempts to invoke the UN Security Council to do exactly this as well. You know, for example, referrals actually to the ICC as a precursor to NATO military intervention in Syria. The Russians and the Chinese had learned, you know, they actually learned the lesson of 2011 in Libya. And that's why they have actually blocked every single attempt to utilize the UN as a weapon of war on the part of the West or the part of NATO in Syria. Of course, you know, people now say, well, you know, why are the Russians actually doing this? Well, because ultimately the Russians have seen how that mechanism has been abused and the consequences of that abuse in 2011 onwards.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they, and they remembered what the Charter of the UN was about.
That's right. Absolutely right.
David Hoyle, it's been great talking to you. This is a wonderful book, Justice Denied, The Reality of the International Criminal Court. And it is available at Africa Research Center. And it, by the way, I like the category you put it under. I think it's lawfare. Is that what it's called?
Lawfare, absolutely.
Lawfare, the use of law to make war. Lovely.
Saturday.
Well, thank you very, very much, David.
It's been a pleasure. Keep well.
Talk again. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
David Hoyle. And that was the law, International Law According to Oil. We are going to take a break. We'll hear a little more of Lee Morgan, and we'll be back.